Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It was a rough day for communication at Lake Effect yesterday. Our email and online calendar programs were working poorly at best. It was a situation that resulted in one, maybe two, or maybe 100 expletives as we all tried to get our work done. You're probably familiar with some of those words, but what would you have said in Victorian England or in ancient Rome had our email suddenly stopped working? Well, aside from what do you mean by email? Milwaukee native Melissa Moore could tell us. Moore, who holds a doctorate in Renaissance literature, is the author of a new book, the name of which would cause us to run afoul of FCC regulations. We'll refer to it euphemistically as Holy S-Word, a brief history of swearing. Moore tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why, of all the subsets of language, she believes swearing is worth studying.
Well, swear words and phrases are important because they affect people very differently than other words do. They have really different physiological effects. So when you swear, your heart rate increases, the person who you're swearing at, their heart rate increases. Swearing relieves pain, it helps relieve emotions. If you're feeling particularly angry or if you're feeling particularly joyful, you know, the best word you can use is a swear word.
Well, and the physiological stuff was among the most unexpected of the points that you make in this book. I mean, there are researchers that you write about that have studied that not only does it just seem like a catharsis or you have this physiological response, but there are studies that show people are less prone to pain if they're swearing?
Yeah, it really is cathartic, right? There's a study that you can hold your hand longer in a bucket of ice cold water if you're swearing than if you're saying a neutral word like shoot. And so, yeah, really it helps with pain relief. And I think this is because it's connected to emotional centers in our brain. Swear words are stored and processed differently in the brain. So they have a lot more to do with what you might call the limbic system that controls emotion and parts of our nervous system that aren't under conscious control.
Well, right. You relate this anecdote right at the beginning of the book about, was it your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother who had Alzheimer's and who could no longer construct a meaningful sentence, but she could still swear. And that was the last word she said to me was a swear word.
Well, okay, so let me get to the other point here. Is it oversimplifying things to say that how we swear defines what we find important or sacred and not even necessarily in the religious sense?
I don't think it's an oversimplification. I mean, I think that's true. Maybe it's an oversimplification, but it definitely is basically true in that people swear about what they care about, I guess you would say. And historically, that's changed in some interesting ways. So, for instance, in the Middle Ages, there were many more religious taboos, and so the really worst words you could say to someone were by God's bones. They were religious oaths based on God and Jesus. And then, you know, in the Victorian era when people got very prudish and interested in decorum, I guess you might call it, then the sexual and excremental obscenities that we have now started to become much more powerful. And then today you've got racial obscenities becoming the really worst words. And I think that, you know, reflects our cultural obsessions, I guess you might say.
Well, so take us through some of this history. I mean, you start with ancient Rome. What forms did these early swearing examples take as far back as you could go?
The ancient Rome stuff I thought was very, very interesting. The swearing was based on sexual taboos, but just very different sexual taboos. And I guess I don't want to say too much about it because it gets pretty – that actually is pretty obscene. But just that they didn't divide people into the same groups that we do. They divided people into what you might call active and passive. And what was stigmatized in the culture was passivity. And so all their swear words reflect disdain for people who, I guess, received sexual advances.
So then how did or why did swearing evolve to these other things, things like bodily functions and sex?
Well, so I think once you leave ancient Rome, you get the Bible and the first religious swearing. You know, there's a lot in the Bible about how you should swear, how you shouldn't swear. And in the Middle Ages, they took a lot of those rules extremely seriously. And that's one of the reasons the religious oaths were so powerful then. The sort of sexual words were not powerful in the Middle Ages because they just had a very different conception of privacy that they basically didn't have privacy. And they did in public a lot of the things that we do privately and are ashamed of. And once you're doing them in public, like excreting and having sex, and if you're not doing it privately, it's very open. You don't have the same sense of shame about it, and therefore you don't need taboo words for it.
Well, and you make a really interesting point here because you have just described what some of these – what we think of as swear words represent. But in almost every case, there is a clinical word that you can substitute for a swear word. And so then why are swear words necessary? Why don't we think of words like excrement as taboo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. It is very interesting. Why? Because we seem to need these words that release our emotions. Right. Yes, there are all kinds of registers for talking about excrement. You can use poop. You can use excrement. You know, you can use a swear word. You know, and we seem to need all these different levels. But the swear words really do something that other words can't.
Do you find any difference? Is there a difference between swearing in print and swearing out loud? I'm not sure I get it exactly, but I feel as I was reading this book that I would have been more squeamish if I had been listening to it than if I had been reading it.
Yeah, that has definitely been my experience. that even people who are very interested in swearing, if you get talking about it, people do get offended. I mean, the power of these words has been demonstrated to me over and over. It's much easier, and it was easier to write about than it is to swear. You know, I don't really swear usually, but I had no problem writing those words over and over.
Let me ask you this. What were the biggest surprises you found as you studied this? And really, how much academic research is out there in terms of understanding where swearing has been and where it is today?
There have been some really good books about contemporary swearing. You know, Randall Kennedy's – I can't even say the title of his book on the air, but it's, you know, the N-word. And there have been another one called Expletive Deleted. But this is, I think, the first history, sort of more popular history. It's, you know, it was written for a general audience. There has been one other academic history of swearing. So it was actually quite hard to research. I had to look at lots and lots of genres of texts. And, you know, in many cases, especially in the Victorian era – the words are not recorded, even though people were using them. The evidence is very sparse. So it was interesting to try and reconstruct that.
Some of the Victorian stuff is, I think we would think of it as pretty remarkable, just the use of the word leg and the use of the word trousers.
Yes. That those things were shocking because the human body was so taboo that, you know, you couldn't say trousers because that might lead you to remember that people had bodies and goodness gracious, where you could go from there.
You write that you yourself were most disturbed by writing about and thinking or talking about racially motivated swearing. Why did you find that was?
I think that is the biggest taboo now, and that I guess I've internalized that taboo. But the F word for people of my generation, I'm 40, I think that's more of a joke. You know, you can – I mean, it's still a bad word, but you can joke about it. You can use it with your friends, but racial slurs are so taboo. Whereas I think for younger people, I think it changes with age. For younger people, they may be slightly less taboo. For older people, you know, even the title of my book can be really offensive.
Well, and what about the notion that the more a swear word is used, the less effective it is? You know, we think back on George Carlin's famous routine about the seven words you can never say on television. And of course, you can say some of those words on television now. Are we always in need of inventing new swear words that are potentially more offensive than the ones that have been rendered obsolete?
I think that is true. I think we are always inventing new ones. And sometimes it takes a long time. Like in the Middle Ages, it was about 1,000 years where by God's bones was the phrase you'd use to insult someone or to relieve pain. And racial slurs, for example, it's only since about the 30s and 40s that they've started to really become taboo. So I think that the time it takes to replace them can differ. But yeah, I think we do need those words. They are those really powerful, emotionally cathartic words. And so that we'll always have a category.
You write that there are some people that would contend that swearing is or can be lazy or a poor substitute for a more creative use of language. Where do you come down on that argument?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously it can be the case that if someone, you know, is just swearing constantly, I suppose it's maybe because they're having trouble figuring out what they really want to say. But I think for the most part, that's not true. I mean, people have done studies about who swears the most, and it's not, at least according to these studies, it's not, quote unquote, uneducated people. It's people in the working classes, but it's also people in the what you might call the upper classes. And people who tend not to swear are people in the middle class because they're sort of worried about appearing lower class. And so I don't think it is the sign of a lazy mind.
Are there swears that you came across in researching this book that maybe you wish would come back into vogue? Do you find yourself saying, by God's bones, when you, you know, hit yourself with a hammer?
No, I don't. I guess I find myself, because I've got two kids, and so sometimes I find myself sort of swearing in a different language or, you know, by God's bones is a good one. I do like that one. But there are lots of good words that have fallen out, but since they're medieval, they weren't actually swear words, but there are lots of good words for body parts and actions that have gone out of use, like sard and swive, which were the F word, equivalent of the F word. Tarse is an old word for penis that I think we should bring back. So there are some words like that.
How did you explain this project to your kids?
Well, I think that my kids have now decided that swearing is uncool. Given that their mommy was working on it, they just have lost interest in it. So I didn't actually have to do that much explaining. Once I explained it, they were like, oh, we don't want anything to do with that.
Well, it is a unique specialty to have. And Melissa Moore, thank you so much for sharing some perspective on this with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Milwaukee native Melissa Moore's new book is called Holy S-Word, A Brief History of Swearing, published by Oxford University Press. She spoke with Mitch Tyke, and you can hear a slightly off-color anecdote she related about kids and swearing at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Shakespeare was no stranger to swearing, and in fact, he invented quite a few creative expressions, even in tragedies like King Lear. We'll talk with the director and the actor playing Lear in the Alchemist Theater's new production when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.